2, 3. 2, 3.
Berkeley.
Berkeley.
Berkeley Sound.
If I could talk.
Berkeley.
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 BerkeleySound.com.
Berkeley Sound.
Great.
The Troubadour Tapes.
I had a goose and the goose pleased me.
Woman's only human.
One less set of footsteps on your floor.
Never saw my hometown till I stayed away too long.
Part and all.
I'm a happy boy.
The Troubadour Tapes.
Stille Gassen, der Wind hat geblost, der Regen gegossen. In mein altes Freundes schmeck ich noch die Halapsis, dem Tan find die Schwemmlach mit Kosche und trink sich die Bittermaschke. Und der Mord verstiebt in der Winkel, steht der Nägel in der Rekord. Sie bett mir, komm schon rein, in dem Café Juzufa.
Hi, welcome to the San Diego Troubadour Tapes and Berkeley Sound. My name's Jeff Berkeley. This is a monthly podcast where we take the subject of an article in the San Diego Troubadour and the writer of that article, an interviewer, and put them together here at the studio and let them conduct their interview here so that we can record it and let you guys kind of in on, the artist's thoughts and their own words and what they have to say as well as the interviewer. Well, this week's interviewer is Alan Singer. He's also going to be writing the article this month on Elizabeth Schwartz, who is a world-renowned klezmer singer. And, I'll just let Alan kind of explain things for you. Alan?
Well, hi, everybody. Tonight we're interviewing Elizabeth Schwartz, who, with her husband, Yael Strom, belonged to Hot Pastrami, a klezmer band that's international, actually. It's not just local to San Diego. And Liz Abbott is here from the Troubadour, and Dan Chusett's over there finding lenses to use. And we're going to talk about a lot of things tonight. We're going to discuss klezmer music, but what we're also really going to try to find out is where Elizabeth got this passionate interest in her voice and how she discovered klezmer music after I heard she used to sing the blues.
That's true.
Yes. So, Elizabeth, probably be helpful to define the klezmer music and sort of show what it's about, that it's not just the music that somehow ended up on Broadway, you know, in a play. It has a whole historic perspective to it.
Yes, that's true. Starting from about the 14th century, Jewish popular music, which was music that was played outside of liturgical music, it was played at weddings, for festivals, for happy occasions like brisses, and comes from the compound word of two Hebrew words, clay and zmiris, tools of the melody. So that's sort of when musicians started to play. Now, it wasn't certainly common for women to play, so there were very rare instances, maybe in the 17th and 18th century in certain parts of Europe, very rare instances where we have documentation of women musicians playing in public at fairs or markets. But for the most part, it was not the woman's province. And also in in traditional Jewish culture, religious culture, it's not appropriate to hear a woman singing. So there is a band, Kol Isha, which I still run into on occasion, where a grown man should not listen to a woman's voice. So I did have a singing background, mostly blues and jazz and the dreaded Broadway standards. But I had pretty much no knowledge whatsoever about what klezmer music was. And it's really, once you start to understand the breadth of klezmer, it's really more of an umbrella term like jazz. There are many different forms of klezmer music. And I'm trying to think, what else should I say about it?
Yeah, but just for instance, you go to a Jewish wedding, mm-hmm. or a bar mitzvah, or you go to the mountains, the Catskills, the mm-hmm. Polish belt, and they'll play Freilachs. Now, is that considered a piece of klezmer, or is that more folk?
No. Freilachs, bulgars, doinas, joks, horas, not to be confused with the Israeli dance, the hora, but the very specific,
form?
Yeah, the 6-8. Mm-hmm. Those are all klezmer styles, and there are many, many more. What happened, interestingly enough, in originating in Iași, Romania, which is also actually where my family's from, was someone who became very well known as almost the father of Second Avenue Yiddish musical theater. His name was Avram Goldfaden, and he was an impresario and a theater guy, originally from Russia, but he was in Iași, where he got the idea to marry Yiddish plays with music and create musicals. So he did that at a theater actually called the Pomel Verde, I think it's the Green Apple Tree, in Iași, Romania, and then he came to New York and started the Second Avenue Yiddish Theater.
Is that sort of related to vaudeville and all that stuff?
Yeah, definitely. Uh-huh. Definitely.
Yeah, it's a stretch in Manhattan, I guess from St. Mark's Place up to about 14th Street. Mm-hmm. On Second Avenue itself, there were a variety of theaters, and they had theater and the music combined. And mm-hmm. They did Jewish Shakespeare even. I mean, it was...
Oh, yeah. It was very serious and very high-quality theater. Mm-hmm. But also there was a certain kind of vocal tradition that was a precursor to what you would hear on Broadway. In fact, the Second Avenue Yiddish Theater had a profound influence on Broadway musical theater. Mm-hmm. Because, let's face it, most of the composers were coming from that tradition.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I discovered a CD recently with Irving Berlin and early Gershwin, and it's basically a derivative of klezmer and Jewish folk. And Irving Berlin's first stuff was very Yiddish kites, mm-hmm. It's an interesting evolution.
Well, and there are famous stories about, for example, Ziggy Elman, who was the trumpeter,
right.
who took a traditional klezmer melody and turned it into what became a jazz standard in The Angels Sing. Hmm. But Carlos Santana recording I Love You Much Too Much, which was a Yiddish song, Ich Hab Dich Zu Viel Lieb.
Yeah, and Benny Goodman. I mean, all that early swing is basically, they could have been playing at a Jewish wedding. I mean, the Angels Sing, I mean, Ziggy Elman's trumpet solo is basically, you got the right one to sing a trumpet solo. It basically sounds like a clarinetist when they really work up the scale. And it's an interesting way of mixing the music. It's swing, but it's klezmer. But the curiosity that everybody has is, how does somebody growing up generations removed from this find this kind of soulful connection? I mean, my generation is before yours. So you're the generation after me. I was a second-generation American Jewish kid. We didn't do what you did. We went the other direction and discovered bluegrass and country blues and all these things. And some of the people who did that are now playing, of course, klezmer.
Right.
Right, but what happened later on? Because you were born late, you know, in the mid-60s, so what was it? What kinds of transitions did you go through to find this?
Well, I can tell you about my own experience,
That's why we're here.
That's why you're here. That's why I'm here.
Yeah.
Not too dissimilar from other Americans, musicians who discovered this aspect of their own heritage. So I'm talking specifically about those American Jewish musicians who, unlike someone like Yael Strom, didn't grow up with the melodies and didn't grow up steeped in Jewish traditions and religious experiences. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a completely assimilated household where I didn't hear Yiddish, and certainly I never heard any klezmer. In fact, you know, I grew up, it was Glenn Yarborough in our house, you know, not exactly...
Yeah.
A member of the tribe.
He does live up in Fallbrook, by the way.
He does?
Yes. Oh. Next to Ken Graydon. You never know.
It's a valuable conversation, right. Alan. Yeah. Now we know. I have to tell my mom.
Well, depend on when you're growing up as a Jewish kid? Does it depend on, like, we had like two Jewish kids in our class, and, you know, so nobody really knew about Jewish culture or anything, except when there was a holiday, and, oh, so-and-so is home for the Jewish holiday, and... You know, whatever, but maybe if there were more Jewish kids, you might have discovered that earlier.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because for the first 10 years of my life, I lived on Long Island in a very Jewish enclave, and where, again...
Great Neck. Yes.
In fact, I will tell you, this morning on Facebook, I connected with the girl who had been my best friend.
In Great Neck?
And then we moved away, and I never spoke to her or heard from her again. Yeah. And she was so, I found her on Facebook, and I said, I don't know if you remember. And she's like, oh, my God, Lizzie. So the miracle of Facebook.
So you lived there for, what, 10 years?
Yeah, till I was 10. And then we moved up to New Paltz, New York.
Yes, New Paltz.
We moved up to New Paltz because my mother was a professor at the State University there.
And is that near Lake Placid somewhere?
No,
it's not that far. It's near Woodstock.
Okay, I know where it is.
Yeah.
Right, for the Troubadour frame of reference,
it's
just below Woodstock.
Yes, and Kingston.
And Kingston. Yeah, right. And across the river from Poughkeepsie.
Okay. And the communist camp I worked at. Anyway.
But when we moved up there, I already told you this, Alan, I'll mention it again. The largest chapter of the Ku Klux Klan in the Northeast was 15 miles away.
Oh, my God.
And... there were no other Jewish kids in my school, and I actually was run out of my school.
Yeah.
And it's okay. It's, you know, I've overcome
that.
She's
still here.
I'm still here, and I've overcome it. But it was really my first brush with any kind of anti-Semitism. And, you know, I switched schools, but I think if I'd had some sense of a Jewish place in the world, you know, I probably wouldn't have internalized it. I would have realized that it was not something that I did not murder my best friend, Maura Jansen's God, even though she told me I did. Anyway, I always felt connected to my Jewishness, but without any real, certainly with no religious connection, but not even understanding a more profound cultural history going back to Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met Yael. And I always jokingly refer to him as the rabbi, because there are a number of musicians. If I say not even just me, but like, you know, the great jazz clarinetist Marty Ehrlich, people who got interested in finding some aspect of their Judaism in a completely non-liturgical way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's through klezmer and through Yiddish culture and Yiddishkeit for me, because, you know, it's very hard for me to go back after so many decades of being on the planet and saying, okay, I'm going to be a believer now.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you didn't grow up with that music or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard, because I was second generation American. My parents parents were here, they were refugees. I mean, they came, some of them came at the beginning of the 1900s. So the Yiddish was in the house, the food was in the house, the Yiska candle was on the table every Friday night, and the cookies were sitting next to them, and it was Yiddish. And then the Holocaust, and it was like it disappeared in a sense, except my grandparents.
Right.
And, you know, I'd go to my Orthodox grandfather, and he's wrapping me in tefillin. So, I mean, I have these experiences, but I didn't come to Klezmer. But then the Holocaust came, and I think people decided we better Americanize in some way.
Well, yeah. I think definitely, you know, really, Germany. Klezmer, you know, post-Holocaust in the United States, Klezmer and Yiddish both became associated with a culture of victimhood. Mm-hmm. And that was also then when people were starting to get excited about Israel, and, right. and then that sort of,
brought it back.
You know, the Mama Lushin became Hebrew instead of Yiddish, and really it was lost. I mean, when you think 6 million, roughly, Yiddish speakers, and who knows how many of their descendants are gone.
Mm-hmm. That's what they call it, a ghost language.
So it really is. I mean, it's a language that few people speak in no country. Mm-hmm. So
recently it's becoming more, people want to learn it more?
Well, you know, there are a number of universities that where now you can major in Yiddish. I mean, you can go to Columbia University in New York and get your degree in Yiddish. Mm-hmm. McGill University in Canada. Real. You know, there are places where you can study, but it's, you know, it's niche.
Yeah.
Just like klezmer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but it is the language of a culture, and klezmer is the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not just folk music. I think sometimes people think it's kind of traditional folky stuff, but there's a depth to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, again, there are many different expressions of klezmer. So, for example, when Avram Goldfaden came to the United States, and he wrote an operetta called Shulamis, which is the Yiddish pronunciation of Shulamit, the Hebrew heroine, ancient Hebrew heroine. And the song Rozhinka's Mitmandlin, which is a standard Yiddish song in the repertoire.
And what does that mean? It's
raisins with almonds.
Oh, okay.
And see, so you probably recognize the mit and the mandlin.
Mandlin,
but
yeah.
Rozhinka's.
Yeah.
How do you say raisins in German?
Rosinen.
That's close. But, you know, just... You were telling me all kinds of stories about Romanian klezmer. Mm-hmm. I think that might be important because you're very connected to that.
I am, and that's, you know, there are two schools, if you will, of klezmer music. One is the Polish-Ukrainian style, and the other is the Romanian style. Mm-hmm. And I was drawn to it not just because of my heritage, but because to me there are idioms in that style that are much more interesting. Probably because of things like the doina, which is like the national folk style of Romania. It is a lament. Mm-hmm. Although with the klezmer doina, you have, it generally means like one slow ornamental piece with a lot of free meter and improvisation, and then it kicks into a happy conclusion.
Like a polka or something?
Well, a bulgara or freilachs, the Jewish version of that.
Okay.
And in Romania, there are, I don't even know how many different styles of doina there are, but there are many. There's a doina for putting your child to sleep. There's a doina for drinking. There's a doina, actually, that I have learned to sing called the Doina din Maramureș, which is, they say, a ca din tulnitz, where a song imitating the tulnitz, which is like a Romanian alpenhorn. So, you know, I just find it much more affecting for me personally, but I think when klezmers heard the doina, they heard aspects of the doina, glissandi, repetition, ornamentation, And they said, we recognize that. Mm. That's Middle Eastern music. Because, you know, Romania was occupied by the Ottoman Empire. And it had a strong influence on a lot of aspects of Romanian culture, including the Doina. So definitely, I find that more interesting because to me, there's something about the melisma of the Romanian style. I mean, and you hear that. That's the DNA of klezmer, mm-hmm. period. Those scales that are, you hear from the Middle East.
Right.
Yeah, so they're not 12-tone scales, you think? You think they're more...
Yeah, the melismatic.
Maybe half steps and different, more flat.
Well, they have specific scales.
Yes.
Because the earliest Jewish music, of course, was the cantor's voice.
Oh,
without
yeah.
instruments.
And without
like
instruments, of course.
The head of the church, in church, like the pastor.
Well, no, that would be, you know, the rabbi leads the services, but the cantor chants the prayers.
Okay.
Right.
So that's the earliest Jewish music. And a lot of those idioms that are from traditional cantorial music are part of the backbone today of klezmer music.
Okay.
So it is a way to connect to all that without necessarily becoming an Orthodox Jew in religious practice,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but where you really can connect. And because, you know, Judaism has such a history of diasporism,
mm-hmm.
It's in our liturgy,
mm-hmm.
it's in our history that... I think for a lot of musicians who are just American musicians playing American music, whatever it was, rock, folk, jazz, old-timey, to connect to that Jewish music in a way almost connects us to the story of that wandering.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so
of course,
it's more
to coming
about the
home.
Lyrics than the music?
No, it's actually, well, the lyrics are probably geared to where the song was written in some way, mm-hmm. tells the cultural tale with the music. You can correct me, but I think it draws from a variety of different countries and cultures.
It definitely does.
Yes,
it definitely music. Does. And look, you know, yeah. because musicians, you see it, you know, you can go to the Roots Festival and see it. We borrow from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you had klezmers, Jewish musicians, traveling the trade route
right.
and stopping here in Constantinople, stopping here in somewhere in the Balkans, and sharing melodies with each other,
right.
and then going on and taking the new melodies to the next place. So, and of course, adopting a lot of the melodies of the indigenous folk. So, for example, there's a very well-known klezmer melody, Lustig Sein. It's got other names, Mayofis, Reb Dovidel. It's just a happy tune.
Okay.
But it was based on a Polish peasant melody.
Mm-hmm.
And more klezmers started to play it. And finally, it was Frédéric Chopin. And we have to remember this the next time you want to play a nocturne. It was Chopin who said to his fellow Poles, reportedly,
right.
we have to stop playing this song. It's become too Jewish. So, but so there are all those things now, but the lyrics don't always reflect
yeah.
the story of the melody because there is also a tradition where people wrote lyrics to existing folk melodies.
Mm.
So, another story, for example, is that there was a great disputation about a folk melody. The Roma were saying that it was Rome, Gypsy.
Wow.
The Jews were saying it was Jewish. The Poles were saying it was this. Everybody was claiming this melody, but I do actually think that research has shown that it's a Bulgarian melody. It was da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
And then Herman Yablokov wrote lyrics, Yiddish lyrics for it, for the Second Avenue Theater, and it became the Jewish song Papirosen,
yeah.
cigarettes.
Hmm.
And another little bit of interesting trivia that was from a play called Der Piets, The Clown. And in the play, a young boy comes on and sings this song about being an orphan and wanting to sell his cigarettes. And who was the young boy who sang the song on Second Avenue? It was the filmmaker Sidney Lumet.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I know. You find all these really fascinating little tidbits of great information.
Well, maybe you can talk about when you met Yale, what happened, or maybe
that's a very interesting story. Yeah. It was actually...
It involved alcohol, you mean?
No, we're not talking about that piece of it, but wasn't it a blind date?
Yes, Yale and I did meet on a blind date. I was living in L.A., and Yale was in New York, and I had recently broken up with an actor, so my mother... hated him, of course. No, he was a very nice guy. But
what's an actor?
He was a nice guy, but nobody wishes an actor for their child. Although, of course, nobody felt that way about klezmers either. And my mother went to a screening at Lincoln Center of Yale's film The Last Klezmer.
Right.
And Yale was there doing Q&A. And my mother said to her girlfriend, why can't Elizabeth meet a nice young man like
nice
that?
I
wonder if he's single. And her friend famously said, Sheila, look around the auditorium at all the old ladies thinking the same thing. Forget it. And then a few days later, a friend of hers said, oh, I went to the premiere party for this film. Oh, how did you get to go to the premiere? Well, my best friend is Yale Strom's literary agent. Really? Do you think he's single? These three ladies, my mother, her friend, and Yale's literary agent, conspired to create this cross-country blind date, even where from... Now, I knew none of this because I would have said no, and you should never say no to a blind date, ever. I am saying this, even if your mother sets you up, don't
you
ever say no because you never know.
You never know.
Right. You got dividends on this one.
Yeah, well, you know, and she also found me a great mechanic, so, you know, she can never be wrong. But as Yale told it, his agent said, oh, Yale, are you seeing anybody? And he said, no. And she said, oh, my girlfriend knows a lot of eligible Jewish women. You should call her. So Yale called this woman, and she really didn't. It was all about just fixing him up with me. But this will say something about Yale. Maybe I shouldn't reveal this, but because he speaks fluent Swedish.
Oh, my goodness.
He wrote the woman's name and her phone number in his address book, and in Swedish underneath he wrote, Jewish women. Because he figured if he ever had a date over and she was nosy enough to be looking through his book, what were the odds that she would be able to decode the Swedish?
Zilch.
This is how Yale thinks. So he never called.
Uh-huh.
And then my mother came out a few months later and said, oh, I saw this wonderful film, The Last Klezmer. I said, oh, that's great, Mom. Oh, yeah, and I saw the filmmaker give a Q&A. He was wonderful. Yeah, that's great, Mom. And, you know, he's such a lovely man. Yeah, that's great, Mom. And I gave him your number. I'm like, what? Don't give people my number. How dare you? Don't do it. And she said, well, it's too late because I already did it. So, look, did he call? And I said, no. And she said, so see, no problem. He didn't call. And then she called her girlfriend. She said, this guy didn't call. What's wrong with him? So this friend said, well, I can't call him because that would be pushy. So she sent him a letter and said, Yale, I know how busy you are with all of your projects. Here's Elizabeth's name and phone number on an index card. And so he took it and he shoved it in his appointment book. And then the magical realist part of this is it was New Year's Day and he was lecturing down in Florida and feeling miserable and lonely. And he went to reach for the TV remote and he knocked the book over and the card fell out on the floor. So he decided to call me.
A sign.
It was beshert, as we say in Jewish. It was destined.
Yes.
So then we had, he came to L.A. and we had a date. And he said, I have to go back to New York, but next Monday I am going to be playing at the Better World Galleria in San Diego with my band. Who was the band? Gene Perry, Jeff Bekarek, Fred Benedetti, and Trip Sprague.
Wow.
And he said, do you want to come down? And I said, well, I'll think about it. And then my girlfriend said, oh, let's go down. We'll have the day in San Diego. And if he's a dud, we had a nice day in San Diego. But of course, he wasn't a dud. And
of course not.
We fell in love and got married. But that was the first time I came to San Diego. And I, you know, I ran the gauntlet of meeting all of the guys in the band.
Mm-hmm. And were you involved in music at that point?
I had been. And then I stopped singing.
Uh-huh.
Because I was a film executive in Hollywood.
Oh.
And so I have a whole nother life that involved much nicer clothes than I wear now. And I would sing for fun with my girlfriend. We used to sing with this stalwart of the Sunset Strip named Chucky Weiss. And we used to sing backup with him for fun. Chucky, famously of the Ricky Lee Jones song, oh, Chucky's in Love.
That's okay.
So we would do that for a laugh. Mm-hmm. But no, I was not singing at all. And when Yale and I met, this is the story that this is the part that involves alcohol. We were dating for a while, and then we went out to Malibu to a party. And I was having, the red wine was flowing. It was very nice. And there was another guest there who was a wonderful songwriter and pianist. And he was playing standards. And the hostess said, "Oh, I love this song. I wish someone here could sing it." I said, "Well, I love that song." And I sat down at the piano and I sang with him for a couple of hours. And I know it seems like I talk a lot, but if you know Yale, you know that I'm definitely the quiet one. And we were driving home from that party, and Yale was so quiet, I thought that he was upset about something. And I said, "Listen, what happened? What's the matter?" And he pulled over on the side of PCH, and he said, "You're learning Yiddish, and you're going to start singing with the band." So at the time, I was so resistant to this idea. I was like the reverse Lucy Ricardo, you know, where Ricky is, as we say in Yiddish, fedraying and chebiting her to sing with the band, and she's doesn't want to. But the guys had a gig in L.A. coming up, and I learned a couple of songs, and Yale went down, and we got engaged. Wow. And Yale went down to San Diego to rehearse with the guys. And said,
he's from San Diego originally.
He's from, he's from Detroit originally, okay. But the family moved here when he was about 12.
And he went to college here.
Yeah, he went to San Diego State.
Right. And then NYU, right?
He went to NYU for grad school. But so, he's a hometown boy. Mm-hmm. And it's nice because, you know, I have a lot of relatives here now.
Great.
But so he was said to the band, "Oh, guys, guess what? Elizabeth and I got engaged." And they said, "Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. Congratulations." And he said, "Yeah, she's going to sing with us tonight."
Uh-oh.
And there was like dead silence.
And they're not orthodox.
And not... Hardly.
Well, is this
and then one of them, I won't say which one it was, because I don't want to get anybody in trouble, said to Yale, "You're going to learn. If they want to sing, you just have to let them." But fortunately... they heard what he heard, so I don't think they objected too seriously.
And is this kind of like part of your, well, you know, the theme of this issue is called finding your voice.
Oh, great.
And so that's kind of like you grew into this thing, and it suits you so well. Your
Thank
voice,
you.
Oh my God, it's like embodies everything about the Jewish culture. You know, the sorrow and the happiness, and it's so passionate and deep, you know, and it's
Thank
just
you.
Amazing.
Well, I really had a lot to learn, not just about the language, but really when I hear like my early recordings versus what I do now, mm-hmm. and I'm so much more comfortable, you know, improvising and sort of walking in and not waiting to be directed, but saying, "Okay, I'm doing this now," and throwing stuff out. And a lot of that has to do really with the musicians that I've been really lucky to work with.
A good musician.
Not just those guys, but also Mark Dresser, who's now here in San Diego and is just a genius. Mm-hmm. And some phenomenal musicians that we play with in New York. Peter Stan, Norbert Stachel, Sprocket, Dave Licht, the guys that are in Hot Pastrami in New York. And also other people that I've been lucky to encounter. Romanian pan flutist Damian Dragic, who is really the world's greatest pan flutist, who's a Romanian Rom. And playing with him, playing with Adam Del Monte, who is based in LA now, but is really just a phenomenal classical and flamenco guitarist.
But from the beginning on, it was like you your repertoire grew and grew, and you became familiar with all this other music and got to know people. And now, I mean, you guys travel internationally. And what's it like, for instance, in Germany now, the culture of klezmer? And I mean, is the Jewish culture coming back to Germany? Or,
well, it's interesting because I think, you know, I'm going in 3 days.
Yeah, yeah. She's
so
off to...
That's right. This will be out. I will have come back, but right. I'm off for another tour in Germany on Friday. You know, when you go to, particularly to countries like Germany, Poland, Romania, Hungary, you know, there is a black hole that... It does it a disservice to say it's the elephant in the room. It is the black hole in the room. And there's no denying that, and no denying that part of what I'm doing coming back is coming back almost as an ambassador of for ghosts.
Yeah, you're filling in the spaces.
Yeah. In Germany, ironically, I'm very comfortable because before there was this enthusiasm for klezmer, there was a very honest accounting. There was reparation, and I don't even mean financial. There was reparation spiritually. There was apology. There was acknowledgement.
Right.
And there was... husbandry for a Jewish population. So there's over 100,000 Jews in Germany.
It was a long time coming. I lived in Germany in the 70s, and it was just then, you know, the children, my generation, that had parents that were in the war, you know, they were just starting to open up and talk about it then. And I think it's just gotten kind of better as the time goes on.
Well, it feels organic. The interest in klezmer in Germany is organic to this embracing of Jewish life versus a situation which I'm happy to say is changing, but the largest Jewish cultural festival in Europe is in Krakow every summer. And you get like 15,000 people coming. And few of the proponents there were Jewish. The Jewish musicians that were there were primarily coming from here. And so while you had this major business, because it was business, where they were recreating this almost Disneyland atmosphere of what Jewish life had been like, and having big nostalgia tourist trade and tours of Auschwitz and Birkenau, you were at the same time not having a thriving, vital Jewish culture there. So it was really, to me, initially, it seemed very crass. But the kind of acknowledgement and embrace of Jewish life it's sort of reversed. It's coming on the tail of this interest in Jewish culture, which had an exoticism to it, I think, for the original proponents, you know, in the 90s, 80s, 90s, and through to this turn of the century, the proponents who almost were attracted in an anti-establishment kind of way to Jewish culture. But now there's been, you know, I think the polls are starting to play catch-up in a way that feels much more wholesome to me. Whereas, you know, I go to Romania, and I'll be going to Romania again and touring in August, and it's very different there. You know, there's a treasure trove there.
Oh, I bet.
Of music and culture, and I'm very excited to be returning. I love going.
Right, right.
And playing with Romanian musicians and Roma there, you know, and kind of getting that cross-pollination of klezmer with other Romanian musics. But... there is really not an interest there in Jewish life and culture, and it's really dwindling there.
Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the goofy, you know, they started as klezmer, but they sort of took it went off on a tangent kind of thing. There are some of those kind of bands around, right?
I guess, you know.
The Fish Tank Ensemble or somebody like
those
that.
Those guys, well.
That's from Canada, right?
No, Fish Tank Ensemble, they're from Northern California.
Yeah.
You know, they're very good musicians. They don't play klezmer.
Okay, they're just elements maybe of it in there somewhere.
I'm going to say not really, no.
Okay.
They do say that they play quote-unquote gypsy music, but, you know, if you ask a Rom, he's not going to say. In fact, I had an interesting conversation last year with Damian Dragic, and we were talking about all of these quote-unquote gypsy bands because there's a really interesting thing happening with Rom culture that we saw happening with Jewish culture, with klezmer culture, which is outside cultures that sort of almost co-opted in a way like Zeppelin did with the blues.
Yeah.
You know, but where the Roma aren't suing. Mm-hmm. So you have bands that, and it's very sexy now to mm-hmm. say, oh, I play gypsy music. Oh, it's sexy.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you ask a Rom, they're going to say, well, you know, that's really Ukrainian mm-hmm. or, you know, no, that's not really Rom music. And as with klezmer music, you don't have to be Jewish to play klezmer. Mm-hmm. There are specific idioms, and once you master them, you know, please.
Yeah.
I want everybody who's a superb musician to play klezmer because it's only better for the whole. It's only better for klezmer.
Yeah.
But you see this happening now with the Roma, where that's now the flavor of the month to say I'm playing gypsy music. And, you know, 10 years ago, these people would have been saying, oh, I'm playing klezmer music.
Right.
It's a bit of cultural co-option.
Right. So
they're not really
exotic.
Interested in, well, you have to understand when a culture comes out of a people and their life and their functional life. So you don't have to be Jewish to play klezmer,
mm-hmm.
but it's disingenuous not to understand the right. source of the music and the original role of the music and put it in its social and historical context.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you see that happening now with gypsy music, where the Rom, for the Roma, the Holocaust never ended. They are still, you go to Europe today, and you can go to Hungary, and there are literally pogroms today mm-hmm. against the Roma.
Really?
And yeah, and people don't really educate, they don't really speak out about it. They just say, hey, hire me for this gig, I'm playing some sexy gypsy music. And, you know, at least have sort of the integrity as an artist and as a human being to, you know, mm-hmm. not just pillage from this culture and walk away. So, you know, and there has been traditionally a lot of collaboration between the klezmers and the Lautari, the Roma musicians.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a very kind of strong and deep and beautiful relationship that came out of their sort of shared pariah status.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, the gypsies were put in concentration camps.
Oh yeah,
alongside the Jews. So there's a lot of parallel. They're also wandered from a variety of countries. You know.
Well, originally just from northern India.
Yeah, that's curious. Isn't it?
Yeah, and actually, you know, you can hear some words. You know, you can hear the Hindi in Romani. I'm not a language expert, so I can't pretend myself to. Except one word I remember a Rom man telling me. I asked him how to say bear, and he said it's balo. And I said, oh, like Baloo,
mm-hmm.
which I knew from the Jungle Book, you know.
Oh.
So, but I didn't know that Kipling had used the actual word for bear. So you can hear these linguistic relationships, mm-hmm. and it's interesting. But they, you know, they've always been outsiders, and they've always been discriminated against. And my first time in Romania, which was in '96, I felt like I had stepped into a Twilight Zone episode. And I said, this is like, you know, 1950s in Sweetwater, Mississippi. This is like what I'm seeing. This kind of state, if not state sponsored all the time, then certainly
right.
state sanctioned
right.
persecution.
But it's prevalent, yeah.
Yeah, and it hasn't changed. And, you know, people really need to be more aware of it. And certainly, you know, gypsy culture is phenomenal. But there are human beings behind the culture, and they have to be recognized.
Tell that story about the cobblestone street in Romania.
Oh, yeah, my nostalgia trip. In 96, Yale took me to Romania. And it was my first trip there. And, you know, I immediately fell in love with the culture, and we stayed with phenomenal friends, this amazing family in Cluj. We're still very close to some of them. And he took me to Iași, Romania, which is the capital of of northeastern Romania, and where my father's family came from. And we had some amazing experiences. We met a lot of Holocaust survivors then, including Itzik Schwartz and his wife Celie. Itzik Kara was his pen name, was the foremost authority on Romanian Jewish culture. Amazing, brilliant man. I mean, he was already quite elderly when I met him, and he would sit around the little apartment. It was probably not little, but it was so stuffed with books that you wouldn't even know. And he'd carry on a simultaneous conversation where he'd turn to Yale and say something in Yiddish, and then he would say something to his wife, Celie, in Romanian, and then he'd say something to me in French, and then repeat it in English just to make sure that I'd gotten all the French. I mean, just nonstop at the cadence at which I'm speaking to you. And I had, you know, when you're American, unless you're Native American, you can't stand on a rock and say, 500 years ago, my people were standing on this rock. We're a young country, and, you know, I mean, it's good in a way. It's the wonderful thing about America is that so many of us are coming from so many different places. But when we were, this day that Alan's referring to, we were in Iași, Romania, and we were walking towards the Mare Synagogue, the great synagogue. And I was standing on a cobblestone, and I felt almost like I had gotten a jolt of electricity. Because on that specific stone, I had that moment where I thought 500 years ago, someone, some ancestor of mine, some whose name I'll never know, stood on this stone. And it's a profound experience. I think all Americans should absolutely travel to the ancestral land.
Yeah.
Just so they can have that experience.
Yeah. That's the way I feel about being in Europe, you know, a lot of times. You know, most of us, well, in my generation, we're like, you know, European, German and English and French and stuff like that.
I mean, I've been to Europe. I haven't been to Poland or Hungary. I've been to Austria, you know, and been to Germany a number of times. And
you should go.
I didn't feel alien even in Germany, you know.
Well, I'll tell you about my first trip to Poland.
Yeah.
We went to a typical Polish restaurant, and they served typical Polish food. And I went, this isn't Polish food. This is Jewish food.
That's the point, except they have pork in it. That's all.
Well, yeah. Except that the food that I thought was Jewish food, it comes from somewhere.
Right.
Do you make pierogies?
I actually do. I have made pierogies. That's not one of my, you know, regular specialties. Mm-hmm. I do cook quite a bit, I should say.
Great.
I eat quite a bit.
Is there, you know, we've talked about Eastern Europe. Is there a Sephardic kind of klezmer? Is it a Ladino?
There is a Sephardic kind of klezmer, but it's not klezmer, because klezmer comes from Europe.
What is Sephardic now?
Sephardic is the Jewish culture of the Iberian Peninsula.
Spain. Oh, okay. All right.
So originally Spain, but then also in Turkey,
Northern
Greece,
Africa.
Because, you know, the North Africa when the Jews were expelled.
Right.
So, in fact, June 13th at the Lyceum as part of the Jewish Arts Festival, I'm doing a concert with Yale and Jeff Pekarek and Lakshmi Basile, Jeff's daughter, who's been living in Sevilla and is a spectacular
dancer,
I mean, just
right?
really breathtaking dancer.
Yeah.
This is a show called Souls on Fire, which examines this nexus from the Golden Age of Spain, where you had Gitano, Jewish, and Moorish cultures kind of intermeshed and married so beautifully. So it's, I'll be singing some pieces in Ladino and in a couple of pieces in Arabic. And Lakshmi
exciting.
Will be dancing. And yeah, it's going to be, it's a great show. It's a great show. June 13th.
Mm.
So, but that has no relationship to klezmer, you know, except for perhaps, you know, when you hear certain modalities and scales that also reference the Middle East. But linguistically, the language of the Sephardic Jews was Ladino, also known as Judeo-Espanol, which is... The foundation for that is medieval Spanish, as we say, the Spanish of Cervantes, mixed with Turkish and Hebrew vocabulary.
No Moorish influence? Or?
On the language?
Yeah.
I do not know.
No, because that was more Arabic, right? So more North Africa.
You know what? It could be.
I'm just guessing.
As a, you know, it could be the same thing that happened to... Yiddish, as Jews moved east, they began to pick up vocabulary from the lands they were moving to, which is why there's so many Slavic words in Yiddish. So maybe?
No, because the movement, if they moved east, they also then picked up music, different types of Eastern-type music. I mean, the Turks. And, well, like, you have Hungarian klezmer. And I've seen some old movies, and Yale told me he actually has the original movie where they have this violin competition between the gypsies, the Rome, and the Jews.
Oh, and the Jew?
Yeah, and Yale actually has a movie of this, because on YouTube they have a little piece of it. But when you listen to the two different violinists, they're basically playing the same. There's a connection there, you know. It's like jazz musicians, they find that common ground.
Oh, sure. And funny that you mention that because, you know, we have a very famous clarinetist, Dave Tarras, and we're doing the July 9th.
You want to talk about the July 9th?
Let me pitch the July 9th concert where we'll be doing some music from the repertoire of Dave Tarras. But this was, you know, this was a very well-known klezmer clarinetist here in the States, originally from Ukraine. But he was known as the Betty Goodman of klezmer, and he would play up in the Catskills. And one weekend, these two black guys walk in. You know, it's a predominantly Jewish audience. These two black guys come in, and they take a seat in the front of the stage. And they came to hear this modal improvisation. And it was Charlie Parker and Miles Davis.
Wow.
So, yeah. And I think, actually, Charlie Parker did a few bar mitzvah gigs with Dave Tarras. So
he did admit to that. I think, yeah, he had to make money. That's, you know, and,
who doesn't?
And
should we talk a little about the Catskills and that culture, or is that just goes way
Catskills,
into another?
Well, you lived, you know, interestingly.
I did, and I lived in the Schwangums.
Yeah, you were in the
different
Schwangung,
mountain range.
As I call the Schwangunk Mountains, you know. Near Kahansen.
Well, because it's spelled Schwangunk, but if you lived there, you'd know it was Schwangum.
I know, but I prefer the other one sounds ridiculous. But anyway, no, but that wasn't that far from the Catskills. Yeah. I mean, you had the Walk Hill River ran there, and then you little, I guess, north, whatever, west of that was the Catskills.
Well, you know, there was a famous resort in New Paltz called Mohonk, which was restricted to Jews. So, you know, we can thank these places that were restricted for the Jews then finding places like, you know, the Catskills.
Well, they used to have Italian hotels, too. That whole crew of that up in the Catskill, they had the Italian hotels. I played a blues concert one night at a Puerto Rican hotel outside of New Paltz in the early 60s.
All right, you got me there.
No, I'm just telling you. That was before you were born, so, you know. But the Catskills was like a percolator.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, because like, you get, you know, you can answer it, but you get the jazz, you get these, the bands with klezmer, because, you know, but then you get Myron Cohn and Buddy Hack and all these comedians doing their shtick, and of course, Joel Gray's daddy, Mickey Katz, who happened to be a very competent clarinetist.
No, he was a great musician, actually.
No wonder he's so talented, Joel Gray.
And he was a crazy comedian. His comedy's great. You know, but
well, he was the
it.
Jewish. He did what Spike Jones did.
Yeah.
Just he, you know, he did it yeah. With klezmer.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't really know a lot about the, you know, the whole Catskills.
That's kind of pretty much dead by now, right?
Which?
The Catskill
they got
culture.
Maharishis and ashrams.
Yeah,
and,
you know, I
actually
I think
the
that's
Orthodox
kind of
Jews. Which probably means that, you know,
the Jews are able to go to Mohonk now.
Yeah,
so.
Probably. But the Orthodox Jews, you know, only the men dance together and they play their own music. And, okay.
Well, that's getting back to that whole forbidden voice, Kohli Shah business.
I mean, quite frankly, I mean, what's happening now with you singing with Yale, and this is, it's modern in a way. It's not, because the religion really doesn't want women and men in the same band, right?
Well, it's not so much the same band. I mean, yeah. If I were playing accordion and kept my mouth shut, I don't think they would have an issue. But, you know, it's interesting. It's almost a little bit arbitrary. We did a concert in Brooklyn, And I saw some Hasidim come in, and they were standing in the back. So Yale, the band played an instrumental tune, and then I came up and I said, okay, I'm going to sing a song now, and I will take my time telling you what the lyrics are in English, figuring it would give the guys time to leave, and they didn't leave. So I just said, okay, well, we have to start. They were moshing. They didn't leave. So, you know, and similarly, last year we did a concert in Jerusalem, and some ultra-Orthodox musicians came in, and they played while I sang. Now, versus someone like Andy Statman, we talked about, you know, who's very traditional, you know, very practicing, and he did 4 cuts on our CD Cafe Juzu, and the 2 instrumentals and on 2 vocal pieces, but he just came in after I had finished laying down my tracks and he played to the recording. So, you know, I think that there is some fluidity.
Yeah.
You know.
It's like klezmer. I mean, the reality is you define it whatever at the moment, you know. And, but where do you see this all going at this point?
Yeah, like what are your plans, or kind of what? How do you, are you just going to continue to spread the word and play wherever you can?
Spread the gospel,
yeah, in a way.
The gospel recording.
Well, you know, as long as I can get gigs,
yeah,
like every musician, of course I will.
Well, it seems like you guys are pretty popular.
Yeah, you
and
know,
you're always out there or something.
Knock wood.
Yeah.
Let
so
me knock wood.
When you come back from Europe, you're playing in town, right?
When we come back from Europe, we have... Well, actually, I was going to mention, because we actually wrote a radio play called The Witches of Lublin, and we're going to do a live reading of that June 6th at the Lyceum. So this will be a staged radio play, and the audience can come in and not just hear the play, but they'll get a sense seeing the Foley artist and the musicians on stage, and be like a Jewish Garrison Keillor experience. Nice. I bring that up because, for me, it's about the message and not strictly the medium. I'm interested in keeping this culture alive. I said once, not to sound maudlin, that when I'm singing, I never really feel like I'm alone. I feel like there's a choir of ghosts behind me. And so to keep sharing this message and telling these stories, you know, whether I do it in a book or in a play or in the music,
in your voice,
that's, you know, that's what's interesting to me is to tell the story, and the ways I tell the story, you know, I'm open to keeping doing it, but you know, certainly, Liz, yes, as long as I can sing,
and
I will be doing it.
I reviewed the album. I mean, I'm trying to paraphrase, I guess, but I felt that what you were doing was singing for the 6 million in some way.
Yeah.
You know, also I'm a mother.
That's
so
true. I met your daughter.
I wanna, it's not just a culture of the past. It is klezmer today is very different.
Yeah.
Well, it evolves. It's very different from how it was 100 years ago, and it's very different from how it was 600 years ago.
Look, they just released that Woody Guthrie album.
Yeah.
With the Klezmatics, where they found these songs. Woody had this thing for his wife's mother.
Right, because his wife was Jewish.
He was a famous poet.
Right.
The grandmother.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he had written, he had this whole treasure trove of Yiddish Woody Guthrie.
Right.
Know? and they put this record together.
You never know. It's like Jewish geography. You never know how, you know, 2 degrees of separation. But, you know, I think it's important to, it almost kind of gets my back up in a defiant way. In a way that kind of hearkening back to that experience I had when I was a little kid in New Paltz, where it's almost a defiant act for me to sort of say, yeah, this is what I do. And, you know,
and I'm here. Wrap it up.
I think you're carrying on the tradition, you know, but in a way that's vibrant and alive. It's not just copycat and
it's not set in amber.
Right, it's not cut in the stone, you know.
It's real.
And it's living. It's like jazz. Each jazz performance is a new performance,
right.
Especially with the improvisation. And I think that's what people have to know, that it's a living, breathing, cultural, musical thing that isn't going anywhere but to continue.
We keep one foot in the past and the other foot walking forward. Yeah.
So is there anything else you'd like to say at this point? Or?
I don't know.
Well,
thank you.
Yes,
thank you. Shane Dunk.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Well, on behalf of the San Diego Troubadour Magazine and Berkeley Sound, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Who do and who do buy the cafe juice?
The Troubadour Tapes.
1, 2, 3. 2 and 3.
Berkeley.
Berkeley Sound.
Give me back my
Berkeley.
BerkeleySound.com.
Berkeley Sound.